Hello, for the lore of the land, this is Jack Leffler. Today on Encounters with Consciousness, we'll hear from Fritjof Capra, author of The Tao of Physics that was first published in 1975. His most recent book, The System's View of Life, A Unifying Vision, which he co-authored with the Italian biologist Pier Luigi Luisi, is a profound work that takes the reader to the heart of systems thinking, using biology and ecology to present the bigger picture of life as a whole. So often, we get hung up in reductionist thinking where we analyze but a single component without seeing the bigger picture, or we follow a single trail and miss the landscape. I was so impressed by this book and the vision that it presents that I contacted Fritjof Capra and arranged to meet him at the Center for Eco-Literacy in Berkeley, California. What follows is an excerpt from that interview wherein Fritjof Capra expresses his perspectives regarding systems thinking to paint a portrait of life on our planet Earth.
I was trained as a physicist, and I spent 20 years doing research in high-energy physics, which is the physics of subatomic particles. And from my student days in Vienna on, I was very interested in the philosophical implications of this new physics. I read a classic book by Werner Heisenberg, one of the founders of quantum theory, and the book is called Physics and Philosophy. In it, he describes this very dramatic period experienced by a handful of physicists when they did experiments with atomic and subatomic phenomena and encountered a reality that was totally foreign to them, and for the longest time they could not describe. The very essence of this shocking reality was that at the atomic and subatomic level, you cannot explain the properties of matter by dividing atomic structures into smaller parts. Although we can say that atoms are made of nuclei and electrons, and the nuclei are made of protons and neutrons, and so on, the properties of the whole of the atoms and of the molecules cannot be derived from the properties of the parts. In fact, the parts do not have any objective fundamental properties. The properties of the parts, of the particles, depend on the dynamics of the whole. So this classical Cartesian way of reasoning to explain a complicated structure in terms of the properties of its parts was reversed. The parts had to be explained in terms of the whole, and significantly the whole includes the human observer and the experimental apparatus. So, for example, take an electron. I can look at the electron in a certain context with a certain experimental setup, and it will appear as a particle. I can look at it differently, do a different kind of experiment, it will appear as a wave. And that, of course, was very shocking to them and took a long time for them to be resolved. The outcome was that the material world cannot be considered some kind of machine made of fundamental building blocks or fundamental elements, basic building blocks of matter. That imagery is just not correct. The material world ultimately appears as an inseparable network of relationships. And so I was very impressed by that during my student years and my years of research. And I then encountered Eastern mysticism in the 1960s, and in the 70s wrote a book exploring the parallels between this worldview of physics and the basic ideas in the Eastern mystical traditions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, and so on. And then I began to see that this change of paradigms in physics had important implications for society as a whole. And when the Tao of Physics was published and was very successful, I met people from all kinds of disciplines and from all walks of life who told me that a similar paradigm shift was now happening in their disciplines. So that led me to investigate biology, medicine, economics, psychology, various other scientific disciplines and see what's going on there. And I had to realize, and now this was in the late 70s, early 80s, I had to realize that the issues I now became interested in as an author, issues such as health or the management of human organizations, economics, ecology, technology, all these issues ultimately had to do with life, with individual living organisms, social systems, and ecosystems. And so I changed my focus, eventually left research in physics in the mid-80s, and focused on the life sciences, especially on ecology, and tried to put together a conceptual framework that would allow me to talk about these issues in a coherent, unifying language, to talk about life of individual organisms, but also social life, ecological life, and correspondingly, say, health of an individual human being, but also the health of a family, of a society, of a village, of an ecosystem, of an economy, and so on. This was then a long process. I discovered the tradition of systems thinking and systems theories, such as general systems theory, cybernetics, and so on. And I put together this framework over the 1980s and 1990s. I published two books about my synthesis at various stages, The Web of Life in 96, and then The Hidden Connections in 2002. And it was only in the last 5 years or so that I completed this synthesis. And this is my latest book called The Systems View of Life, written with a colleague, Pierluigi Luisi, who is a biologist at the University of Rome, and published by Cambridge University Press. Now, interestingly, I coined the term The Systems View of Life already in my second book, The Turning Point, in the early 80s. And so your question really was, what is this systems view of life? And this refers to a conceptual revolution which is related to the conceptual revolution in physics, but occurred in the life sciences, where people have also discovered that you cannot represent or think of living organisms as machines composed of elementary building blocks, but have to see them as inseparable networks of relationships. We have also discovered that the planet as a whole is a living, self-regulating, self-organizing system. Accordingly, the human body as a machine and the mind as a separate entity have given way to a conception that sees not only the brain, but also the immune system, the bodily organs and tissues, in fact, every single cell, as a living cognitive system. So cognition and life have become intimately connected. Evolution is no longer seen as a competitive struggle for existence, but rather as a cooperative dance in which creativity and the constant emergence of novelty are the driving forces. And with the strong emphasis on complexity in recent two decades, on networks, on patterns of organization, a whole new science of qualities is beginning to emerge. So I've given you some highlights of the systems view of life, and to go to the very essence of it, we can say that there has been a profound change in metaphors from seeing the world as a machine to seeing it as a network. And everything else follows from that change of metaphors.
One of the things that has inspired me for many years is the book entitled Mutual Aid by Peter Kropotkin, the turn of the 19th, 20th century anarchist philosopher. But near the very end of that book, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, but not much. He said that evolution of species, and parenthetically culture, human culture, owes more to mutual cooperation than mutual antagonism.
Absolutely, and that has been the observation in biology and evolutionary theory now for a very long time. The emerging systems view of evolution is a Darwinian, the Darwinian concept of a common ancestry and of a long descendance of gradual variations and followed by natural selection. That basic insight of Darwin is still correct. And in our book, actually, we have three chapters on evolution, and we begin with an homage to Darwin, because this vision of a vast network of organisms interlinked in space and time is an absolutely awesome vision, which I think gives a scientific, I wouldn't say basis, but a scientific pendant to the vision of many indigenous peoples who say, you know, the trees and animals out in nature are all my relatives. Well, they are, literally, in the Darwinian sense, because an oak tree and I have a common ancestor, and we know enough about evolution to follow this tree of life back to the common ancestor where the human being and the oak, you know, are joined. So that's an absolutely awesome idea. Now, the novelty in the last 20, 30 years has concerned not the basic idea of evolution, which is well established, but the dynamics of evolution, the mechanism through which evolution takes place. And in the so-called grand synthesis or neo-Darwinian theory, there is random mutation and natural selection and nothing else. Now, biologists have discovered there are actually three avenues of evolution. Random mutation is one of them, but random mutations are not very productive because most of them are not viable, except in the case of bacteria, because bacteria multiply so rapidly that even a small part of a mutation, you know, a very rare one, you know, can multiply very rapidly and then become dominant. But bacteria have a second avenue of evolution, and that is the horizontal transfer of genes. Bacteria in their daily lives spit out genes, part of their genome, and other bacteria absorb it. And they exchange genes like this in a completely everyday routine way. The great microbiologist Lynn Margulis, who also influenced my thinking very much, put it that way. She said, it's as if you jumped into a pool with blue eyes and came out with brown eyes, because there's this exchange of genes in the meantime. So that is a very effective way of changing the genome. And then finally, bacteria and all living organisms do something, that is, they ingest small organisms, microorganisms, and absorb their genome and integrate their entire genome into the larger genome of the organism. It's as if a large corporation needed a telecommunication system and bought a small company who was a telecommunication company and ingested the company and absorbed their telecommunication system. That's what bacteria do with genomes. And a critical point is that in all these three avenues of evolution, random mutation, horizontal gene transfer, and the acquisition of entire genomes, when the new genome is formed, this is a highly complex process, which is highly ordered and is ultimately cognitive in the new sense of cognition, because it is part of the self-organization of the organism. So although there are random elements in evolution, most of it is highly ordered and cognitive and part of life's self-organization. And that's, of course, a very big step.
One of the things that brings to my mind is looking at the planet itself as a living organism or a compilation of trillions of millions of living organisms within a geophysical vehicle. But there's a sense of reciprocity between the geophysical and the biological and the atmospheric.
Well, absolutely. That's the big conceptual revolution of Gaia theory. So the traditional view was that the rocks and air and oceans of the planet were the stage on which life appeared. And then somehow life appeared by chance or by something coming in from outer space or by something we don't know. So life appeared and then evolved on this stage of rocks and air and water. Now, the systems view of evolution, first of all, has realized that evolution began before the evolution of the first cell. So there's now something we call a prebiotic evolution. And my co-author Luisi is actually one of the world experts in this very exciting discipline, and he wrote a chapter about this in the book.
This is prior to Luca.
Prior?
Last universal common ancestor.
Yes. This is prior to it. Yes, absolutely. This is an evolution of molecules in tiny bubbles, like soap bubbles, bubbles with a membrane of fatty tissues of, that are called lipids. And so within those bubbles, molecules evolved. And those are purely physical processes. There's no proteins, no DNA, and so on. And then, you know, eventually they got more and more complex. And then after the appearance of the universal common ancestor, the bacteria, who were the first living organisms, unfolded, and first of all, they immediately formed communities, the bacterial colonies, and then occupied all the niches on the planet and set up a communications network. This exchange of genes and signals is also a global communications network, and began to regulate the composition of the atmosphere and the composition of the rocks and of the oceans. And so life prepared the environment for further life to evolve. And that happened for a full 2 billion years before the larger organisms evolved. So life prepared the scene for further evolution to happen. And it's an sort of humbling thought that, you know, we pride ourselves on a global communications network and on our technologies of genetic engineering. Well, the bacteria have been doing this for billions of years. And in fact, all the creativity of life ultimately goes back to the creativity of bacteria. This insight was dramatically confirmed in the Human Genome Project about 10 years ago, when geneticists analyzed and mapped the entire human genome and found that the genes are full of bacterial genes. So a large part of our genome is bacterial genomes. And so, again, you know, cooperation is pervasive in evolution.
One of the things that was fascinating to me, remains fascinating to me in your book, is your discussion of cognition. And in a way, what I'd like to ask you to address, if we can frame it somehow, is how, as in those earliest cells, cognition, well, maybe defining cognition within that context,
yes,
and then how that has ultimately, within the context of life, led to consciousness. And that to me is a biggie.
Yeah. Well, this is obviously a very complex issue, but the key insight is simply to describe. It was not a simple matter, you know, but it's easy to describe. And we have to go back to Descartes, who was the architect of the mechanistic worldview in the 17th century, seeing the world as a machine, living organisms as machines, the mind being totally separate from matter, and so on. So Descartes made this fundamental distinction between mind and matter as two independent and fundamentally separate realities. One he called the thinking thing, the res cogitans, is mind, and matter he called the extended thing, the res extensa. And so for centuries after Descartes, philosophers and scientists have been wondering how this thinking thing, the mind, could interact with matter, or in the human body with the brain or other parts of the body. And the big advance of the last 30 years has been to realize that mind is not a thing, it's a process. So that's the huge step. And the process is called cognition, the process of knowing. And cognition becomes closely associated with the concept of self-organization of living networks. Cognition is actually the process of self-organization of life. So that when you have, say, a cell, the simplest living organism, then the constant generation and regeneration of the cellular components, the process of self-organization that determines how the cell functions and lives. It's not determined by outside forces. The basic rules of interactions are set up by the system itself. That's why we call it self-organizing. And the process of self-organization is cognition. It's a mental process. So this was discovered by Gregory Bateson in the late 1960s, and independently, almost in this, at the same time exactly, by Umberto Maturana in Chile. And then Maturana and his colleague Varela elaborated this theory into a theory of cognition, which has become known as the Santiago theory, because they worked at the University of Chile in Santiago. And so the Santiago theory says that there are these two aspects to life, structure and process. And the structural aspects are the biological aspects we know and we study with biochemistry and biology. And the process aspect is cognition. And so as living organisms evolve, both the structures and the processes involve hand in hand. And so as the biological structures become more complex, so does the process of cognition. And you have various structures and organs that are evolving specifically to monitor and direct these processes of cognition. We're talking, of course, now about the nervous system. And with the evolution of the brain and a higher nervous system, in all mammals, and maybe even in some higher vertebrates, there's an emergence of a sense of self, which is the emergence of consciousness. And cognitive scientists, which are now related to neuroscientists and biologists, because it's always the relationship of process and structure, so cognitive scientists believe that consciousness emerged first as a transient phenomenon of organisms becoming aware of themselves in transient moments. So a self-awareness that sort of arises and subsides again. And as organisms become more and more complex, and now we're talking about the great apes and hominids and humans, this consciousness, with the evolution of language and conceptual thought, becomes permanent and becomes a permanent feature of the brain and of the mind.
There's the word autopoiesis, is that it?
Yes. I have tried to avoid technical terms. The theory of living networks as self-organizing and self-generating networks is the theory of autopoiesis, which means self-making, by the same scientists Maturana and Varela. And the cognitive part is the Santiago theory of cognition.
To me, that's just brilliant.
Let me add something so that we don't forget.
Yes.
I don't think we'll have time to talk about this, but the last part of our book, The Systems View of Life, is about the practical implications of this systems view. And it is called Sustaining the Web of Life. And it has three chapters. One is a chapter on ecology, the history and the basic principles of ecology and sustainability. The second chapter is a systemic assessment of the problems of our time, which are all interconnected and therefore are systemic problems. And at the very root, in my view, of these systemic problems is our obsession with unlimited growth, unlimited quantitative economic growth, which is, of course, an illusion, because on a finite planet, not everything can grow. And so this illusion of perpetual growth is something that I want to counteract with the concept of qualitative growth. And I have a whole section in the book about qualitative growth. And the basic idea is that when you see that economic growth really is the motor of capitalism, the motor of overconsumption, and therefore of waste, of pollution, of species extinction, all these problems we have, also the maldistribution of wealth, the economic equality, all this is driven by this obsession with economic and corporate growth. And so some people say, in Europe especially, there's a movement of no growth or of negative growth. And I believe that this is cannot be held up, because when you look at life, then you see that growth is a fundamental property of all life. You know, all living systems grow, but not everything grows at the same time. So in an ecosystem or in an organism, certain parts will grow, but other parts will decline and disintegrate, and their elements will be then liberated and be used for further growth, as nourishment, as resources for further growth. So qualitative growth would be a system where certain parts in the economy would be allowed to grow, but other parts would have to decline. And so we need to distinguish between good growth and bad growth. And of course, from an ecological point of view, that distinction is very simple. Growth that increases global warming, growth that uses non-renewable resources, that uses toxics, that pollutes the air, that destroys community, that increases economic inequality, is bad growth. And the growth that does the opposite is good growth. And so that's how we need to qualify growth. And I've been fascinated by this idea, and I developed this with a colleague of mine, Hazel Henderson, who is a sort of eco-economist. And I've been fascinated by the fact that this idea of qualitative growth is very consistent with the system's view of life, which is a science of qualities. So there's a shift from quantity to quality, both in science and in this notion of growth.
We've been listening to Fritjof Capra discussing his recent book, A Systems View of Life, A Unifying Vision, that he co-authored with the Italian biologist Pier Luigi Luisi. This book was published by Cambridge University Press, and it provides a clear perspective of systems thinking. Encounters with Consciousness is a production of The Lore of the Land, funded by a grant from the Christensen Fund in San Francisco. For The Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.